proof of service that the individual who is mailing it states that I placed such and such a document, so many pages, into the mail, and you specify a post office address, physical
that's
address.
Right. That's right.
If you include that in your proof of service, the court will accept that.
Yeah, that's all it takes.
No. In your
all right, now, hold on a second. Hold on a second. One thing before we get out of control here. If you are opening up a brand new case and you're serving somebody by mail, yes, that is a problem. Okay? Don't. If you just serve by mail, that is a problem. Okay? So that's not really going to work well. The courts have flexibility in deciding whether or not service was sufficient, okay? There is some flexibility, but proof of service is pretty narrowly defined in that it basically you have to have the proof of service, and if you're doing a substitution process, it's a physical delivery backed up by a postal delivery. The two in combination make the service valid. If you only have one half of the leg, it isn't going to work. Okay?
Bill.
And it could work if you have a special circumstance. All right? But it has to be very special. The court is authorized to make some exceptions to it. All right? And I'm going to get further down the line. There's more to the story. But basically, the proof of service is a two-pronged effort if you cannot find the person directly.
Right. Or if you have defendants in multiple states and it's maybe physically impossible for you to do your own physical service.
Yeah, there are exceptions, like I said, and there's a lot of discretion on the parts of these judges. Now, I haven't gotten into those problems, so I cannot speak with authority. But I will tell you this, that this is all in the rules of court or in the civil procedure somewhere in there. Okay, so you just look up proof of service, you'll find it.
However, right. It's like Pamela said, if you have someone who will testify that they delivered these documents in and mail that should be sufficient to take care of the problem with the green card that you just talked about.
Well, you don't need the green card.
Right,
okay.
but this will take care of that.
I think we're getting off track here. I worked for an attorney as a process server, and what Bill says is true and correct. On the first serving of a case, you serve the person in person. You don't do it by the second means. You have to get them served in person. If the case is already a going case, then you can serve them second process.
By mail.
By mail.
And only by mail.
If they're in other states, then you have to find a process server in that state that will serve them. That's just the way it is.
Okay. Now,
okay.
But let me say this, that like I said, if you have an exception, you can always go to the court and make a motion. Okay? You can make a motion asking the court to acknowledge that this is good service.
That's right.
So, you're not stuck. But there's more to the story, if we can get past this point. So far, we've got two levels of service. Yeah,
okay. Also, on the fact of going on to the second level, you need to do at least diligence. I found an affidavit of diligence. We've knocked out where they haven't filed proper affidavit of diligence or had flawed statements in the affidavit of diligence in that they attempted three times to serve personally and were not able to. If you can find flaws in that, you could pick it apart and throw it out. If they don't have that and they go to the second level of service, you can also knock it out. I have done that personally. As far as other states, you often can get a sheriff to serve for you, and you just find out who the local sheriff is, ask what their service is, and you can do it through them. I've done that a number of times also.
Yeah. But look, the basic concept is that you serve them personally the first time, and if you can't do that, then you can serve them with substitution of service the first time. It's okay. You don't need special approval procedures to be able to leave it with the adult that's there and then mail the second copy to them. That works for an initial lawsuit. Okay? After that, you can do just mailing. Okay. But now, here's where the fun starts. We have another level. Okay? And that is that, let's say that you go to the place where the person lives. The lights are on, the door is locked. Of course, you're not going in anyway, but you know, you knock on the door, there's no response, but you know he's in there. Okay? You can go back and petition the court. That's another motion, by the way. You can petition the court to break down the door. Okay? To use force, a forceful service. If the court authorizes it, you take the authorization to the sheriff or marshal. They will go over and bust the door down and serve the guy. Okay? But you have to certify that he's hiding in there. All right? So that's another technique. Another technique is that you can serve by publication. And you have somebody that you know he's around somewhere, but you can't find him. You simply don't know where he is. Now, the courts do not like service by publication because, I mean, who reads these legal notices, right? But technically, that's how it's done. But you go to the newspaper, you publish like so many repetitive times, so many weeks or whatever. You served it by publication, and now the court will recognize that. But before you can serve by publication, I think that on that case, the courts do require a statement of due diligence. You got to show that you really tried, that this guy, you can't find him. All right? So that's another technique. Another technique is to have the clerk do the service, in which case the clerk always does it by mail. I'm not sure what the circumstances are for that. I've never done that, but I know that system exists. Finally, push comes to shove. You know the person is somewhere. You just don't know where. Somewhere in the state, maybe. Could be in Northern California. You're in Southern California. Where is this person? You don't know. All you know is his name, maybe. Where he used to live, maybe. Something. So what you do is you serve the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of State is responsible for finding him. Okay? Now, how that works, I don't know, but I know it's in the rules. Okay? You can serve the Secretary of State as a last resort. So, it is not possible for anybody to hide from a lawsuit. You will end up with a judgment one way or another if you follow the procedures. Yes?
I went to serve a county sheriff, L.A. County Sheriff.
Sure.
And he would not tell me where his office was, so I went to the headquarters.
That's the best thing to do.
And I took it and I asked for the person who accepts the summonses to come out, and they did. And they came back and said, well, he doesn't work out of his office. He works out of another office. And they gave me that office, and we called, and he wasn't there.
Uh-huh. But so, he doesn't have to be there.
So I know. They said he did not work out of the other office. So if I went back to the headquarters, I could maybe give it to any officer. Is that right? Who is coming in and out of that office and get them served?
No, it would be anybody who appears to be in charge of the office. The phrase is apparently in charge of the office. Doesn't have to be in charge, but is apparently in charge. If you run up against the gatekeeper, that person will not let you pass, then that's the person apparently in charge of the office. That's all. You can ask for the manager. If they refuse to get the manager, obviously the person you're talking to is the person apparently in charge of the office. Got that word, apparently. That's all you need.
Okay, well, where I went is at the on Temple Avenue, mm-hmm. on the ninth floor, where it is locked, and you have to have a plastic key to get in.
Well, that's fine. If they isolate themselves, you just go back to their boss, you know. You're serving the sheriff anyway.
You go back to
the
sheriff.
Well, that's right. You're serving the deputy. But you see, look, you go wherever he works out of, if you know for a fact he's a sheriff, then you just go to that office where the headquarters are, right? Because they're in charge.
Right.
Right? They certainly know where their people work. And if they're playing the hide-and-seek game, that's no big deal. You just go back to headquarters, you drop it off, you say, this is for this guy, and then you mail a second one there, because after all, that's where he works. And that does it.
Well, they hoodwinked me, and I didn't give it to that.
Well, that was
gatekeeper.
Today. Tomorrow it's different.
Okay, so I can do it again with him.
Sure.
Another trip.
No, that's all right. It's good for you. All right, so you see, so you have your different levels of service. But whatever you do, you make up a proof of service. Okay? In other words, you just describe what you did and you declare that this is in fact the truth that you're telling. This is what you did. And now they're served. So those are the levels of service as I understand it. And all of that is described in these books. If you look at the rules of court, California Rules of Court, or you look in the Code of Civil Procedure. I forget where it is, but it's in there. Okay? Just go to the index and, index and look up proof of service. Now, okay, speaking of rules of court, as a little side note, there are four sets of rules of court that you need to understand exist. Okay? The first rules of court is not actually rules, it's code. If you look in the Code of Civil Procedure, it describes service. Okay, you got to read that section to get the full flavor of it. The second set is called California Rules of Court, or CROC for short. I'm not joking. It is CROC. Okay? California Rules of Court, that's the big book. That's fairly thick. Then you have the local rules of court. That's your third set. So you go to the particular county that you're in, the super, you know, whether it's the superior court or the municipal court, which doesn't exist anymore in most counties, or whatever court it is, you go to that court, to the clerk, and you get a copy of the rules of court there. So that's your; those are referred to as local rules. Okay, so you got the state rules of court, California Rules of Court, you have the local rules of court, and the Code of Civil Procedure. The fourth set of rules is usually just one page. And it's the rules of the particular judge's court. And it's something like no chewing gum, you know, during court and session, cell phones shall be off, you know, the little stuff. But it's typically about one page long. And so you need to, you really ought to find out what the rules are there too. So whenever you're dealing with rules of court, look up, remember there are four rules of court.
How yes. Are you going to take the court or in past the guards?
Court order. You go to the court, you make a motion. Remember, you'll understand this. What I need for you to do, I think I need to remind you of something back here. Okay? Let's get off here. Because your question tells me that you forgot this. And I know everybody forgets it, including me. So I'm going to go back to this. I think it's the foundation. Yes. This is a quote by Cicero. Wise men are instructed by reason. Men of less understanding by experience. The most ignorant by necessity and the beast by nature. Mm-hmm. And this is Cicero, okay? Now, this court of record stuff that I'm talking about requires you to be on that first line. Wise men are instructed by reason. You have to have, or if you don't have it, you better develop it. If you're going to successfully use sovereignty as your foundation for what you do, you've got to learn to reason. If A is so and B is so, then C must be so. Okay? You've got to go through that logical pattern. A lot of people, I'll tell them about how you make motions and so forth, and then they say to me, show me an example. Now, seeing an example is nice. It helps to shape things. But that's secondary. The primary thing is that you need to know that if you're a sovereign, and you're the sovereign of the court, you're the plaintiff, and the court consists of the suit, the person in suit of the sovereign, wouldn't you conclude that you're in charge? By what authority do the people you hire presume to overrule you? I'm talking about judges. Okay? Now you've got to reason this out. Because if you don't have that reasoning process, if you have to sit around and wait for experience to hit you, if you're on the second line, then this is not going to work for you. Because a lot of times, you're getting hit with something unusual. Why? Because you hit them with something unusual, and you don't know how they're going to react. And so you have to be able to get a a clear understanding of what it is that this is about, have the right perspective, so that you automatically come up with the right answers. Okay? From A. Now, here's how you do this. When I started out, my biggest question, I was just like everyone else. I said, okay, the theory's nice, but how do you do such and such, whatever it is? Okay? Took me a long, long time to get past that stage. Because why? I was living by experience, and I would glom on examples of motions and things that people did before I found this general pattern. Okay? But the bottom line is, you have to be able to say if something's so and something else, you got to trust your theory. Okay? Because there's not much examples on a lot of this stuff. The very first order that I ever issued in court, it wasn't even my case. I was issuing it on behalf of someone else. I was operating on raw theory. I didn't even have examples or experience or anything else from anyone. I had just concluded it from pure, unadulterated reasoning process. And I didn't know if I was going to end up in jail or not. Okay? But there was a guy that was in jail, and I determined for my own satisfaction that he was a political case. He was being persecuted. Okay? And I decided to get involved. And he understood sovereignty. He protected himself well. And he was being held by the municipal court, and he moved for habeas corpus from jail into the Superior Court. This, by the way, was in Redwood City. And so he put in this handwritten habeas corpus, and the Superior Court judges just routinely denied it. Okay? But you see, he knew it was his court. So I went up there, and I agreed that I would get involved. And so the first thing I had him do, because he was sovereign and it was his court, I had him appoint me as a special master in his court. Now, special master is like a judge without the pay. Okay? And I had whatever authority he granted to me as a sovereign. And by the way, that's all a judge can do. Whatever authority the sovereign grants him. So he granted me the authority to investigate, inquire, to take depositions, okay? And to do whatever was necessary in order to move the process along. But I still did not have the authority to make final judgments. All right? So, that was on a Monday. I went down, I filed it, you know, got immediately upon filing, got several certified copies because I thought I might need that, such, you know, in the Superior Court. I went over on the following, or during that week, there was a rumor, jailhouse rumor, that he was going to be pulled into court on Friday morning. So we took that seriously. I prepared an order halfway, and I went down to the court, and before the court session started, I got an audience with the judge. I again dressed like an attorney, okay, nice pinstripe suit, etc. And I explained to the judge that I had been appointed, this is municipal court judge, that I'd been appointed as a Superior Court master of the court, special master, and that when he called this particular case, that I would be there to observe the proceedings. And I showed him my paper, which, by the way, had been signed by the prisoner, because he was the sovereign of the court. See, and I had his seal, by the way. It was signed, it was sealed, and it was filed. So he acknowledged it. When he called the case, I stood up, and I was standing right between the public defender that had been assigned to him, and the prosecutor was on my left. And at some point, I got an opportunity to start talking. And the judge and I went back and forth, and I explained to him that who I was, and I said I'd been appointed as a special master of the Superior Court, and that I was here to observe the proceedings in this particular case in the municipal court. And I said, I'm here now declaring the Superior Court of the State of California open and in session. So here we were with two courts and one courtroom. Now, this was all on raw logic. again, I thought my way through the problem, and I understood habeas corpus. There, it was the prisoner's court, okay, in the Superior Court. That Superior Court outranked the municipal court, part of the same system. So I figured I outranked the judge. I had greater authority. So that's how I presented myself as a Superior Court special master. So we started talking about it. I said that that there were certain issues involving common law rights, and the judge informed me that the common law had no standing in this municipal court. So I agreed with him. I said, "Yes, Your Honor." I said, I agree. You are correct." But I said, in Miranda versus Arizona, the court had said that where substantive rights are concerned, there shall be no rulemaking. You cannot legislate either for or against substantive rights, common law rights, in other words. Change the word, but it's still common law rights. So he agreed, yeah, that was true. So we had a little pause there, and I always like to tell this story. And during the pause, prosecuting attorney stood up, district attorney, and she said, "Your Honor, who is this man? I don't know who he is, and I don't know what he's doing here." Now, you know, the judges and the prosecutors are pretty much in bed with each other. The judge just sat there and stared her down. He just looked at her, didn't say anything. Finally, she sat down. And then he turned back to me and picked up on our conversation as if she were not in the room. Can you imagine that? Well, I'll tell you something. Up until that moment, I was running on pure reasoning process. But when I saw how he mistreated that prosecutor, how little recognition he gave her, my knees stopped shaking. I knew I had struck gold here somewhere, okay? Maybe I didn't understand exactly why, because I was still on theory, but there was something going on, because why else would a judge give a third party, intervening party, the time of day, right? And why would he ignore a prosecutor who we know he works every day with, and would give the respect and so forth? Doesn't even respond. She was like out in left field as far as he was concerned, I guess. Anyway, he said to me in his conversation, he says, "Well, what is it that you want me to do?" Again, I was a special master, so he addressed me personally. He says, "What do you want me to do?" Well, because I was a special master representing the court, I could not tell him what I personally wanted him to do, which might have been to go fly a kite or something. Okay? So what I did is I stuck with the theoretical script. I'm here representing the court, so I'm going to tell him what the court wants. Okay? So I said to him, "It is the wish of the Superior Court that the Municipal Court release jurisdiction of this matter to the Superior Court until such time as the issues in the Superior Court are settled." And he said, "I will do that if you will give me the order in writing." And I said, now I could say, speak personally. I said, "Well, I came here with an order half written because, frankly, I didn't know how this session would go. But if you will recess the case, during the recess, I will prepare and complete the order and deliver it to you when you recall the case." And so he did that. And boy, was I rushing around, writing it out by hand. First half was typewritten, the second half was handwritten. And I got copies made and, the whole bit, and came back. When he recalled the case, we passed it through the marshal up to the judge. And the judge read it into the record and then ordered the paper filed into the record. And then he terminated the session. And that was the end of the business for the day. Now, I know he was going to research it to see whether or not he could put me in jail. Okay, but nothing ever came out of that. We progressed to the next point. But I thought it was interesting, you see. But how did that all come about? Because I had no prior examples. Raw logic. Raw reasoning power. You've got to somehow acquire that skill. Now, I'll tell you frankly, it's not easy. okay? Not easy at all. But there's a method that I recommend to you for doing it. I've given you these highlights. We've been here all day on this stuff, okay? I've given longer sessions. But the key to picking up on this is group action. Pick a case. Pick the most serious case you got running in your group. Get three or four together and actually group think on this thing. Because what one person forgets, the other will remember. It's amazing what you can dredge up out of your memories if you have a group working on it. You produce those papers, and the mere fact that one person explains something to the other person will crystallize the concepts in your head, will cause you to dredge up things that you thought you forgot. So that's my recommendation. You absolutely must work together. None of this entrepreneurial, independent stuff. You've got to work together. Invite your friends. It's really critical. It does not work when you go it alone when you're just learning. Here you are, a bunch of you. I don't know, pick your friends. Work together, because this is how you learn. This is how I learn. I learn by teaching. And I got involved with over 150 cases. And I can tell you, working with different people, first people ask questions, and I say, oops, you know, I never thought of that before. And or maybe I did think of it before, but now I have second thoughts that are better. So group action is the key. Okay? All right, so any questions? All right, well, let's see. We have... All right, let's see. We have procedure, right? Back to procedure.
This might be a good time to switch audio
tape. Oh, sure. Okay, time out for tape change. Now, we have... I'm back at the home page of this CD. This is the law notes. And we have the reference law books. All right? Now, you heard me talk a lot about Matthew Bender's books. I made some excerpts. My understanding of of the copyright law is that for educational purposes, you can copy sections and so forth, you know. And that's what I've done here. And I have not copied everything in Matthew Bender that they have to offer. But I'll tell you something. If you take a diskette with you and you do battle with the library's computers, you can, when you do your research, you can copy off of their computers onto your diskettes whatever you need from Matthew Bender's. Okay? It's wonderful. Let me show you what you get with Matthew Bender's. Okay, we have two books. We have Forms of Pleading and Practice, and we have Points and Authorities. Okay, so they have the books there, but what I do, for some reason, the books are a little easier to use than the computer, at least for me. So I go to the books, I pretty well home in on what I want, and then I go to the computers to actually dig it out. Okay, so I went to two parts. We have one set of books which deals with California Forms of Pleading and Practice, and then the other book, which is the Points and Authorities, and also Argument. Okay? They don't talk about it. It should be Points and Authorities and Argument. But they just call it Points and Authorities, or it's also called a brief. Of course, as you know, some of the heaviest documents around are called briefs. But anyway, so let's look at motions. And so here are some specific ones, like a motion to strike. There's a motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict. You know, like you get a jury verdict and you say, hey, wait a minute. Even if they did decide that way, I want a judgment that goes the other way. And so this gives you the arguments of when that can be done. You can do a motion in limine. Remember, all motions are basically the same principles. But with a motion in limine, basically, you can do discovery on the other side. Now, I told you that in common law, there is no discovery. At least there's no discovery from the defense to the plaintiff, okay? Because you put in all the evidence when you filed your lawsuit. But they don't know that, even though you're at law.